Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Are you looking for a way to break the summer heat and all the heat waves we've been having? Huh. I've got an answer for you. Might not be what you expect. Coming up on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on Heritage Radio Network. And indeed, we are recording this during the hot summer heat. And it is something that I thought would be so appropriate because it really did cool me off. And I'm talking about the cuisine of Antarctic, of the Antarctic. And I'm not sure whether this is the culinary history of the Antarctic or the history of culinary deprivation, but it is indeed an interesting read. It is a story called Hoosh, Roast Penguins, Scurvy Day, and Other Stories of Antarctic Cuisine by Jason Anthony. And Jason, I have him on the line from Maine. It must be a little cooler up there than it is down here anyway. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
Good, thank you. Jason is a veteran of eight seasons in the United States Antarctic Program. He writes a blog and has wonderful photographs posted online of the of his excursions. And he tells a tale of the history of the Antarctic explorers as well as modern-day Antarctic, the United States Antarctic Program and National Science Foundation programs. Jason, tell me, how did you get involved in going to the Antarctic?
Well, like so much in my life, it was really a question of happenstance. I was in a poetry MFA program at the University of New Hampshire. And one of the other people in that program, actually he was in the fiction program, was a guy named Jim Mastro, who has now also put out a couple books about Antarctica, mostly about diving underneath the ice there. But he was in the fiction program, and we became friends, and he told me all about the Antarctic, and it seemed like a really next logical step after getting a master's in poetry. You know,
were you that hard up for material to write about, or?
It's just something you wanted. Not so much a question of material as the dearth of jobs waiting for me, I think.
Yeah, well, that's...
No, it just seemed like a really good adventure, and it wasn't on my radar at all, really, before that. But but this opportunity came up, and I had done a lot of backcountry, hiking and canoeing, and so going to sort of a difficult place didn't bother me too much, although, of course, it was quite different than, say, hiking on the Appalachian Trail.
Right. Well, then you immersed yourself in the history of the explorers of the Antarctic. But before we even go there, because we're obviously want to talk about the food and the food issues,
right?
Can you explain to our listeners, I mean, we've all, in our junior high science projects and history, we've read about different things, all of us, I'm sure, and some went on to study more, but really describe to us what the terrain is in that region and what a so-called summertime would be.
Sure, yeah. Well, we're talking about a place that's as large as the U.S. and Mexico combined in area, although my favorite comparison is that it's about the same size as China and India combined.
Wow.
But it's, instead of 2 billion people, there are maybe 7,000 peak population during the austral summer. To give a sense of the Antarctic, you want to sort of think about the sort of three main landscapes. You have the coast, which is what most people who have an image of Antarctica in their head think of, you know, where you have icebergs and penguins and that sort of thing. And that's where I spent most of my time. And I would see in the summer a temperature range of, say, 25 below to 40 or 45 above.
Huh.
So not so different from, say, northern Maine, let's say, or, you know, that sort of thing. But most of Antarctica is not the coast. It's the interior, and then there's also the Transantarctic mountain range. And once you get into the interior, you're talking about, the coldest place on Earth is in the middle of Antarctica, a recorded temperature of about 129 degrees below zero. That's a wintertime temperature. But at the South Pole, where the landscape, you know, is just flat and white, it's snow on top of about 2 miles of ice.
2 miles thick, right? The ice is two miles
deep.
Thick.
Yeah, the thickest part of the Antarctic ice cap is about 3 miles deep. Really, just a phenomenal amount of water locked up in ice there. Enough, if it all melted, that the sea levels around the world would rise about 200 feet, which is a lot of water when you think about it.
Yes.
And but at the South Pole, summertime temperatures range from about, let's say, 55 below to zero, maybe a few degrees above zero. A heat wave would be, say, 5 or 10 degrees, quite unusual.
And I would imagine it's a very dry heat as well. I mean, dry cold. Dry.
Exactly. Yeah, it's extremely dry in the Antarctic, and that plays a role in the cooking, of course,
right.
As well in today's world. But it played a large role in the explorer's experience as well, severe dehydration. I'm sure we'll get to that.
Right. One has to wonder why an explorer ever thought to go there in the first place. I guess it's there, so they have to conquer it, right? It's like that mountaintop.
It's that blank spot on the map, you know,
right.
Coming out of out of that whole sort of European desire to make their map of the world. What's interesting is, as one writer has said, is that Antarctica, you know, went from becoming an unknown blank spot on the map to a known blank spot on the map.
Yeah, right.
In that you're looking at a lifeless terrain, you know, this is larger than the U.S.
Well,
what
I wanted to get to was, you know, you've just described a very bleak terrain and unhumane weather conditions. So food is a real issue. And the first explorers who went, I mean, many of whom died, but there were some who went back multiple times, and I think particularly Sir Ernest Shackleton. Can you describe what they did as far as what happened as far as food? Would they had to bring everything with them?
Correct, yeah. When you think about what these early explorers had to deal with in terms of food, there's sort of two main situations. You have what they would bring to live on. Usually they would live either on board their ship or in a hut that they would build on the coast. And that's one scenario. And the other is when they would make treks into the unknown interior, where they could only carry a minimal amount of food. So on the coast, they lived off of, in large part, what they could carry in their little wooden ships coming down through the ice sheet from Europe, but often they couldn't bring enough to sustain themselves for, let's say, you know, say 30 men, you know, for 2 years.
Now, did they? Aside from the weight, I mean, did they underestimate the caloric need in those temperatures as well as the, you know, the heavy work they were doing?
I think, you know, there was enough background in Arctic exploration that they knew that deep cold required, you know, more food, but they were limited, you know, simply by what they could fit on their ship, and they would bring an approximation of what they lived on at home, in a sense, you know, the flour and sugar and canned goods and whatnot, and then they would supplement that as necessary with the local wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Now we're talking the late 1800s for the first explorers, explorers.
The first, it's funny. I like to say that Antarctica was the only real sort of significant place actually discovered by Europeans. You know, everything else, people have been living there for thousands of years. And Antarctica is very new in the human experience. There's no Aboriginal experience there. It wasn't sighted until 1820. The first people to spend a night there, as it were, to spend the winter, was 1898. So this period of exploration that we're starting to talk about here, the heroic age, as it's known, starts starts in 1898 and goes to about 1922. After that, we start looking at machines and things. But they were supplementing to a large degree their diet with penguins and especially seals. Mm-hmm. And the good news in this is that there were plenty available on the coast. There was absolutely nothing available once they went inland, but on the coast they could really they could just walk up to any of these creatures and kill them. They had no fear of a terrestrial predator like man because there was none.
Right. And which, just to alert our listeners in case they're appalled by this, the cute little penguins, that they are now considered endangered or just it's outlawed to kill them?
They're not endangered. Populations are quite healthy. There's all Antarctic wildlife is protected now, in my experience from 1994 to 2004, all of that occurred well after all of the wildlife had been protected. So I have not eaten a penguin or a seal, mm-hmm. But they were an essential component to the survival of early explorers.
Well, now your title of your book is Hoosh, and you talk a lot about Hoosh throughout the book. Describe what that is for our listeners.
Sure. Well, it's a really interesting word. It's a fun word to say. And it's a sort of linguistic cousin of the word hooch, which many people are familiar with as a sort of a slang for cheap liquor. But for British polar explorers, it was a slang term for a stew they would make from pemmican, which I'll explain in a second, and melted snow, basically. And they would often thicken it with a crushed biscuit, sort of like the endurance a carb that the explorers, British explorers, were fond of. Sort of a hardtack.
Right.
And pemmican, for those who don't know, it's a Native American word. It's an Ojibwe term for a really the perfect endurance food. It was the best sort of emergency/endurance food ever created until modern science has come up with at this point. Sort of the Clif Bar type stuff. Those little packets of goo that the Tour de France riders use, but pemmican really was it's the origin of the endurance foods that are popular today, and it consists of they would take the meat of a lean meat of an animal, say an antelope or bison, they would dry it, then they would grind it, shred it into either powder or fine shreds, then they would mix it 50-50 with the fat, rendered fat of that animal. And they sort of basically make a block of this dry protein and fat. And sometimes they would mix some dried berries into it to give it a little bit of flavor. On an intuitive level, they knew that the berries were good to fend off scurvy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the time we get to this heroic age of Antarctic exploration, pemmican was no longer this sort of Native American creation. It was an industrial version being made by a couple companies in Europe, and it was sort of a canned food. And it sort of had the consistency of a hard cheese, and I think it looked a lot like we think of sort of like kind of a imagine like wet dog food in a can, except without the wet, denser. And it's most what's beautiful about pemmican is that it represents the most amount of calories you can pack into the smallest amount of space and weight. And that is the gold standard when you talk about exploration into inhospitable conditions, where there is no food waiting for you.
Mm. So a very little of this would go a long way as well when making a hoosh, right?
That's correct. To make the hoosh, they would take a packet or a can of this pemmican and put it into the pot of water, which was melted snow. The one thing Antarctica does provide in large quantities is snow to melt for water. As long as you have fuel, you can melt snow for water.
Right, that's what I was going to say, because there is such a danger of dehydration in the Antarctica that you think, well, but there's all that snow, all that water, except you need to melt it, right? So you need fuel.
Right. Yeah, and eating snow directly, as some people may know, is you burn a fair amount of calories warming snow to a point where your body can then take it in as warm water, and so there's not a lot of energy gained in a sense in eating snow directly. And these guys, you know, when they were on the trail, trying to be the first ones to the South Pole, for example, or mapping unknown parts of Antarctica, dehydration was a really constant state because they couldn't take the time or bring it, you know, enough fuel. They didn't conserve their fuel to be melting water, melting snow all the time. And these guys who were trying to go to the South Pole, for example, the first attempt was in 1903, then in 1907, Shackleton got very close, and then finally it was reached in 1911. They only had water at their three hoosh meals a day, and that was it. Uh-huh. And they're burning tremendous amount of calories and expelling a tremendous amount of moisture while traveling across that landscape.
Well, your descriptions and stories, I mean, taken in part from a lot of the journals and letters and histories written, were just... I was in a complete deep freeze and a feeling of starvation. I mean, these people dreamt, and talked about food all the time because they had none. Is that correct?
I think the unstated thesis of my book is that, you know, the worse the food, the better the story. You know, which is not sort of what we think of in terms of food typically, at least in the foodie world.
No.
I think whenever you're in extremis, you know, there's that longing for things you don't have, and so even in the huts, they had sufficient amount of food and they were sufficiently warm, they were still dreaming of the better things at home. But then once on the trail, things really got desperate, and they were carrying pemmican and biscuits and maybe a few little treats like some cocoa powder or tea, and that's about it really.
And having to parse those out over, you know, how many months and how many weeks it was.
Right, right. As Robert Falcon Scott said, you know, the trick is to supply each man with just enough food to get the job done and nothing more.
Huh.
And then so that you can make your distances and go beyond where anyone or any human has been before.
Well, you mentioned dehydration being a problem, but also you mentioned also scurvy, and scurvy was one of the dangers that, of course, many people weren't aware that was going to occur, and then it did. Then they learned more, and some of these groups of explorers were wiped out due to scurvy. What did they do to correct that?
Well, yeah, scurvy has a really fascinating history, and you could do a whole show on scurvy if there's anyone interested in listening.
Mm.
But scurvy, as people know, I think is a deficiency of vitamin C. Vitamins weren't understood, weren't identified in a sense until late 1920s. But the experience of scurvy was deeply known through European culture and around the world, really, but especially in the British Navy, let's say. And there's this funny history here where science really got in the way of the solution. Medical science got in the way of the solution, where through sort of a bit of early science and whatnot, they realized that citrus would cure scurvy and prevent it, in fact, if you took it as a preventative. But then over time, through some mistakes that were made, cooking up, rather than having fresh citrus, they would cook it in copper pots, and that would actually destroy the vitamin C. Of course, they didn't know that was happening. And then they switched to limes, and limes don't have as much vitamin C. And so you have this process by which the cure became thought of no longer as a cure. And so, we're well into the early 1900s, you know, where really amazing things are starting to happen in science. You know, we're talking about, you know, the origins of atomic physics and all this stuff, and we still have guys dying of scurvy in the Antarctic. And the one thing that was understood by people in the Arctic, by the Inuit, and by some people who respected what the Inuit knew, the Norwegian explorers in particular, they knew that you could also get vitamin C from meat, but meat had to be raw or very lightly cooked.
Now that was the one thing that just astounded me. That like a aha moment, you know, that I learned from this book, and that meat, you could get it from meat. Go on, yeah.
Yeah, and again, no one really knew the mechanisms here. The Inuit didn't know the sort of vitamin mechanism, you know, and all this, but they'd been living in the Arctic for 10,000 years, and whatever that time frame is, And they knew that, you know, they're in a place where there are no fresh plants of any kind for a large part of the year. And so they subsisted on a diet of raw or very lightly cooked meat and fat. And scurvy was rarely an issue unless this was a question of unavailable, you know, if they couldn't get food at all. Interestingly, there was one American doctor, Frederick Cook, who had traveled with Robert Peary in the Arctic and who spent a winter in the in a Inuit community. This is before he became known as the guy who faked reaching the south of the North Pole first. You know, that whole famous debate about whether Peary or Cook got to the North Pole first. Peary was given the prize, and Cook was called a faker, and he probably was a faker. But before that, he had been in the Antarctic on the first expedition to spend the winter there, and he brought his sort of Inuit knowledge to bear on this crew that was getting very ill from scurvy. In fact, one of them died of scurvy, and forced them to eat penguin and seal meat, and it saved them all.
Well, fortunately, things have changed a lot in the situation of food with all the studies going on, and we're going to talk a lot about that when we come back and about your recent explorations and your preparations when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
You're listening to Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from A Taste of the Past.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Well, we're talking today about Antarctic cuisine, and which, you know, may seem like an odd thing to be talking about in the middle of summer, but it makes me feel cold. And my guest is Jason Anthony, and his book is really quite a riveting tale of explorations. It's called Hoosh, Roast Penguins, Scurvy Day, and Other Stories of Antarctic Cuisine. And Jason, you went on I'm going to repeat that you spent 8 seasons. Those are the summer, if you will, seasons, right, in the United States Antarctic Program. But you did one particular, not exploration, but I guess a job, for 100 days, and you had to prepare 3 meals a day for 100 days. Tell me a little bit about that and what it was you were doing.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience getting ready for that trip. I'd been working on the ice, as we say, or in the Antarctic, for several years at that point. And had sort of moved increasingly into doing what we call field work, you know, leaving the main U.S. community of McMurdo Base.
But I'm going to preface this. This is already, okay, because we were talking about what in the old days and the explorers, but this things have changed. There's a base camp, and it's well-equipped, right? And you've got supplies coming in and out, and, okay, people, and we have indoor greenhouses. We're going to save that one, but all kinds of, you know, interesting things that help supply the food, and you left that camp. Okay,
now right. You can go on. the U.S. Antarctic Program has 3 bases: the McMurdo Station, the South Pole Station, and then there's one on the Antarctic Peninsula over on the South America side, which is called Palmer. And McMurdo has over 1,000 people, and you have planes coming and going, and ships coming through the ice toward the end of the summer, and helicopters, and trucks. And all sorts of things, and dormitories and all that, and of course, relevant to this conversation, a large cafeteria. But yeah, I left all that behind in a series of short trips in previous seasons, going out to these field camps, these temporary tent-based camps in various places in East Antarctica, West Antarctica, and in this case, in the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. And the goal here was to create an alternative, an emergency landing field or emergency runway for a plane that might be coming into McMurdo, wasn't equipped with skis, and suddenly was not able to land there in McMurdo because of bad weather, which we get fairly often. And so the New York Air National Guard wanted us to build an emergency alternative up in the mountains on what's called a blue ice glacier, which is a glacier that gets so much wind being funneled down from the East Antarctic ice cap that there's no snow on that ice surface. So we were about 5,500 feet, about a mile high, and there were two of us, my friend Julian Ridley and myself, and we were to set up camp for just over 3 months and to create, you know, sort of mark out this runway and then maintain it in case anyone needed it. And we had to sort of set up, prepare for the entire season ahead of time, including food, you know, 100 days of three meals a day, plus lots of snacks for two tall, hungry guys. And you know, it's not a particular skill of mine to really plan ahead for weeks for trips. I've done it for, you know, 2-3 week trips, and you know, you figure it out. But this was on a scale that I had not done before, and but we were told to make sure we had everything we needed for the entire time because they weren't sure if we would get a resupply flight at any point during the summer.
Well, that's kind of scary. I mean, and anyone who's done any camping knows that. I mean, that, you know, you got to be careful on how much weight, and you got to plan, and then you're always hungrier than you thought you were going to be, and
right.
And go on.
Luckily, weight wasn't an issue because we ended up, we were taking thousands of pounds of material out there. We had a tractor, for example, a small Kubota tractor. We had drums of fuel. We had hundreds of these large markers to mark the edges of the runway, and so a couple hundred pounds of food here and there didn't matter. So weight wasn't an issue. Available quantity of food wasn't the issue. It was really a question of figuring out what we wanted to eat, when we wanted to eat it, and figuring out quantities. Of everything from, frozen tortillas to frozen pizzas to, cans of this or whatnot. And we did a pretty good job. We spent a few weeks getting everything ready in McMurdo, both in terms of, the tractor and the food and radios and all that stuff. And as it turned out, with going through the season, we had flights coming all the time, so we were able to supplement here and there. But yeah, it was quite a task trying to set all that.
I mean, it's
300 meals,
Yeah, I was going to say, going to the store and planning for a week, if you have to, is daunting enough. Much less 100 days for two people.
Keeping it simple helps, and we had a fairly, by Antarctic standards, we had quite a luxurious long list of things to choose from. And that actually, in a sense, it almost made it more difficult.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but, you're working, and it's just the two of you don't have a staff, so you have to come back, just like any, I think camping trip, you have to come back, and you have to have the energy to prepare the food
right.
as well, right?
That's right, yeah. And you have a simple sort of a two-burner Coleman camping stove, propane-fired, you didn't have to worry about things spoiling. That was the good news.
Right.
Our temperatures range from about 20 below to 20 above during that time, over the course of the summer. Go ahead.
I wanted to kind of get back. So you survived. That's great. I'm glad because you could write the book.
Right.
And as it turned out, supply planes could get to you. But if you, in your thought of not having anyone be able to fly in additional supplies, what was the bulk of the food that you packed? Was there any one thing that became the most important item that you packed or packed a lot of?
Well, we grabbed as much Cadbury chocolate bars as we possibly could, and then took some more too. Luckily, a friend of mine was running what we call the food room, which is the room that disperses food to field camps, and Cadbury chocolate bars were sort of on everyone's wish list. I think we managed to Julian and I, being our charming selves, were able to steal a few more than we probably should have, but we would carry them in our parka pockets. We had them stuffed in snowmobile in the seats, on snowmobiles, and we ate them all the time.
Well, good quick energy and fat. I mean, that's good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all about survival. And but the thing that comes the hardest, that even today in the Antarctic research or Antarctic life. Our fresh vegetables and fruit, and that's something you can't obviously bring large quantities of going into an unheated tent for any length of time, so we brought a few odds and ends out when we first got out there, and then as you mentioned, we had resupply flights, either helicopters or planes stopping by once in a while, and so we would get some extras, and then one day a helicopter showed up with a large box of fresh fruit and vegetables and a 25-pound bag of potatoes. Now, remember, this is just two people, and we have to keep this food from freezing and try to make use of it as quickly as possible.
Oh, that's right. So, it's too cold. It's gonna self-destruct if it's left in the ambient temperature.
Broccoli and lettuce doesn't like 20 below very much at all. And so in order to keep the stuff unfrozen for as long as we could, we sort of took care of the most delicate things right away, and then the other things we would just take into our sleeping bags with us at night to keep them from freezing. So, the bag of potatoes, of course, wouldn't fit, but, cucumbers and cabbage and Lord knows what else, so we were able to make use of most of it. We didn't lose very much, but because it just feels, it's very, I think, serious sin by Antarctic standards to let fresh food go to waste.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, I often in reading through the book, it kept popping in my head, necessity is the mother of invention. And certainly when you have limited ingredients, you start to get very creative with how you're going to consume them, especially if they're not edible as in their, raw state. So I'm sure that there were a lot of interesting dishes that came, not that you'd ever want to prepare them again, but some interesting dishes that came out.
It's amazing how good things taste when you're hungry, and that's of course the sort of watchword with camping anywhere, is that the further you are from regular food and the hungrier you are, the better the mishmash that you just put together tastes.
That's right. Well, tell me about the greenhouse. Tell me about the base camp. Let's talk about McMurdo, because that's one of the most popular and larger camps.
It's by far it's the largest community in all of Antarctica. It has over 1,000 people.
Well, I liked how you said the United States Antarctic Program is the largest group of humans on ice. I thought that was a rather clever description.
Yeah, when you think of, because it isn't, when you think of people in Antarctica, if anyone never thinks of that, we're told by the media that it's all researchers, and you sort of think of like one big happy camp full of scientists from around the world. But in fact, all the nations that have research bases down there they have their own national base. They may be next door to another national base, and they may share logistics, as we do, for example, with the New Zealanders. But it's you have sort of these sometimes quite isolated bases scattered around the continent, and most of them range from say a dozen people to maybe 100, whereas McMurdo is, as I say, is over 1,000. South Pole is also an American base, and that's the second largest base on the continent. That is over 200 in the summer. All of these bases have a much smaller population in the winter because much less is done. And winter in Antarctica, of course, is much colder. It's completely dark. There's no flights, no ships. Everybody kind of hunkers down, and you have a skeleton crew to sort of keep things going. But McMurdo is a fascinating place. There's over a dozen dormitories. You have I'd say over 100 buildings all told, between, you know, from warehouse, everything from unheated warehouses to the large cafeterias called the galley. You have administrative buildings, and
it's hard to imagine from seeing the pictures of the old explorers living in these rudimentary huts. I mean, and crude igloos. I mean, amazing.
Yeah. Well, in fact, McMurdo sits at the spot that's sort of most famous in Antarctic exploration. It's as the early explorers figured out, it was it's the southernmost point you can get to on Earth by ship. So therefore, it was a great access point to the rest of Antarctica, particularly, you know, in their quest to get to the South Pole. And
So at McMurdo, you have greenhouses and cafeterias and food dispensaries.
Right, and the and, you know, and this whole complex of buildings, it sort of towers over, in a sense, one of the very first huts built in the Antarctic in 1901 by Robert Falcon Scott. And so, you know, people walk down to what's called Hut Point, and there's a little hut down there. It wasn't so much the hut they lived in; they lived mostly on the ship, but they had this 14-by-14-foot hut for storage and whatnot. But
it's kind of like a museum.
Hut is quite a place in Antarctic history.
I was going to say, like a museum, right? Like a museum, and also a stark reminder of what it was like.
That's correct. Yeah, outside the hut is a sort of a the remnants of a seal from a later expedition. There were some people in a fairly desperate situation who were using that hut to stay alive while they waited for the sea ice to freeze up again, so they can get back to their hut, which is several miles up the coast. But yeah, so there's a lot about that hut that reminds us of that early difficult time.
Well, and some of these old camps and huts and people have found surviving bits of food as well. pemmican, for one, which I guess is indestructible. But you mentioned the oldest can of pemmican that was? Oh, there was a box of food that was found, right?
I'm not sure.
I don't know if it was a box of food or was it just a log of pemmican that was about 40 years old or something?
I'm not sure. I know there was, when I was out at the on the glacier in that three-month journey, we found a box of food that went back about 40 years. And that was from, I think, some New Zealand a mapping crew back in the late 50s, early 60s. But in these huts, in Shackleton's hut at Cape Royds and Robert Falcon Scott's hut at Cape Evans, and then in that little hut known as the Discovery Hut right near McMurdo, there are, like I say, everything from remnants of penguin and seal to going back, you know, over a century to cans of cans of little delicacies that they had on in their stores. They brought down things like, you know, Moir's lunch tongue, and or canned jellies, or or Coleman's mustard, you know, that sort of thing, and Coleman's flour. And these huts have been cleaned up and sort of established as museums in a sense, although very few people ever get to visit them, by conservators who are hoping to maintain that history against the ravages of Antarctic weather.
Well, whatever the scientific explorations and designs they have on the area, it certainly is keeping it very active. And I thank you for your part, Will. It's interesting to read about, and this indeed too will go down in history. And if anyone wants to cool off without getting too hungry, I did get pretty hungry reading it. It's a very interesting read. It's called Hoosh, and my guest has been Jason Anthony. Jason, thank you so much for sharing your time. And if you go back out there, please be careful.
Okay. I will. Thank you, Linda, very much.
Okay, thanks. This has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.